From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The ghost called Anne. That a prison cell could become within a few months so horrifying that it had to be closed, never to house another convict, seems unlikely enough. That the succession of events which caused this were due to the ghost of an actress is even more unlikely. Yet no other alternative has ever been advanced to explain what happened to cell number 7 in the 4th Precinct Police Station, New Orleans, in 1872. Early in the morning of November 10, 1872, Mary Taylor was cut down just in time by a jailer who discovered that she had tried to hang herself by a makeshift rope from strips of her cheap cotton dress. Dr. Paul Wesson, who had attended her, and Captain Doyle McKenna, a top-ranking detective, were summoned, and between them the two men gradually extracted Mary Taylor's story from her. She had awakened during the preceding night to see a luminous figure coming towards her. It was that of an elderly woman in a stained and crumpled dress and slippers. This figure had fixed her with such an intense stare that she had been unable to look away. The detective's casebook records indicate that Mary Taylor said, "She compelled me to get up and tear up my dress in strips and make a noose. I could not resist her terrible eyes. I fastened one end of the rope to the bars, put the noose around my neck, and then kicked my stool away." As they listened to this and other details, Desk Sergeant Dugan and Captain McKenna realized that the girl had given an exact description of a drunken old woman, once an actress in New Orleans, named Anne Murphy, who had hanged herself in the same cell 5 months earlier. As a part of her theatrical life, Anne Murphy had been a stage hypnotist of remarkable talents. She had filled the music halls of New Orleans with the strangest feats anyone had seen. With her hypnotism, she even induced people to steal for her. The more recent history of that cell had been far more fantastic. Incredible as it now seems, since the day when the old actress had hanged herself, 13 other prisoners had also committed suicide in it. In all that time, the jailers had been trying to discover what was causing such a death list, and a suspicion had formed in their minds that the death of Anne Murphy had triggered off the situation. Now they appeared to have confirmation, but they were not satisfied. They decided to lay a trap for whatever nefarious agent was at work. Searchers spent a long time tapping every brick in the cell, inspecting the bars, the grill, and every crack on the walls, floor, and ceiling. When they were satisfied that no human being could either make an entrance into the cell or cause anything to be passed through into it, they laid their trap. The time came when they booked a Florida fisherman, a complete stranger to town, for a minor offense. After lengthy questioning, officers were satisfied that their captive had never heard of Anne Murphy. Cell number 7 was opened up, and the slightly intoxicated fisherman gratefully sank down into the bunk inside. Within a few minutes, he was snoring loudly. Outside in the corridor, Captain McKenna, Sergeant Dugan, and the jailer prepared to watch all night. Even though the three men were certain that nobody could enter without their knowledge, two patrolmen were also on watch outside the prison in a position immediately opposite the cell. Every 5 minutes, one of the men in the corridor slid back the cell grill and with the aid of a lantern took a look at the sleeping prisoner. Soon after 4 o'clock, the fisherman's snoring stopped suddenly. Captain McKenna slid back the grill very slowly so as not to make the slightest sound. To his amazement, in the short time since the snores had ceased, the fisherman had fashioned a twisted cord from strips of his shirt, the other end of which was tied to one of the bars above. McKenna bounded into the cell and slashed at the improvised rope with a knife. The other two men caught the prisoner as he buckled. Then they carried him along to McKenna's office, while all the time the prisoner kept shouting, "Keep her away from me! Keep her away from me!" After a few cups of black coffee, the prisoner gave an account of the ghost as Mary Taylor had done. After that, the cell was never used again for imprisonment, and it became a storage room. The Unlucky Theater. For a score or so of years, there stood in New York's Broadway a theater called the New Theater. It was regarded as unlucky by those in the theatrical profession because for a very long time no play produced there had been a success. Many thought that it had a forbidding supernatural aura about it that inhibited prosperity. An old actor called Charles O'Farrell became interested in the occult aspects of the theater and as a psychic person himself asked the then owner of the theater if he could spend the night in the theater to investigate any preternatural qualities it might have. The owner raised no objection to O'Farrell's vigil, provided that he did not supply any comment to the newspapers. This was agreed, and it was arranged that O'Farrell should go to the stage door an hour after curtain fall on a Monday night. O'Farrell arrived in time and was let in at the stage door by the night watchman, whose place O'Farrell had agreed to take without pay. After the watchman had conducted O'Farrell around the theater and showed him how to cope in case of fire, the old actor was left alone. The theater seemed uncomfortably lonely, and after the watchman had gone, there was an eerie and depressing stillness about, unbroken except by creakings in the woodwork. O'Farrell, who had spent some 50 years acting, never realized that a theater could be so quiet. For half an hour or so, he wandered up and down staircases and along the corridors, lamp in hand, peering into boxes, side rooms, and cupboards. Then he went backstage. Thick dust lay on the piles of ropes, pieces of torn scenery, and grubby costumes. There were signs of long neglect everywhere. For a while, O'Farrell thumbed through an album of faded theater bills he had found, and as he put the volume back on a ledge, he heard a movement in the stage manager's room. He cautiously pushed the door of the room open, and he saw a man with a folio in his hand, pacing up and down as if he were learning lines. On hearing the door open, the man stopped and stared at O'Farrell, a guilty, startled look in his eyes. The watchman had told O'Farrell that there was no one in the theater, so what was the man doing there? There was something very odd about him. He wore clothes in fashion some 20 years before, and somehow didn't look quite real. O'Farrell noticed, too, that the man's shirt front was stained with what looked like blood. Probably prop man's dye, he thought. "What are you doing? Who are you?" asked O'Farrell, holding the lamp up to get a better look at the man. As he stepped forward, however, the man inexplicably vanished. For a moment, the old Irish actor was stunned, but continued a little shakily, his rambling around the musty old theater. Around 1 o'clock in the morning, O'Farrell sat himself in the pit and ate his sandwiches and ate a little sweet pastry he had brought along with some hot coffee, something to keep him awake. Over the top of his cup As he drained it, he saw a dark-haired woman climb up onto the stage, look around the house, and disappear through the curtain. "Hey!" shouted the actor, clambering up onto the stage after her, but she too had vanished. Maybe an hour or more passed, and O'Farrell was getting bored. Not tired, just bored. He settled himself in the front row of the stalls and looked around him at the seedy decor. Although it was a summer evening, the theater felt cold, and the actor distinctly felt that feeling coming on. Charles O'Farrell was a good Roman Catholic and didn't have anything to do with spiritualism. In spite of his beliefs, however, from childhood he had the talents of a spiritualistic medium, fight it how he might. He involuntarily had associations with spirits of the dead. As he sat there in the dark, he experienced the familiar bodily numbness he knew preceded all his manifestations. The theater began to take on a fresh, new, clean look, and the auditorium was bathed in golden light from the sparkling chandeliers above. Around him, people began to take form, all in costumes of a bygone era. In minutes, the dress circle, the balcony, pit, boxes, and gallery were no longer empty, yet the faces of these people were corpse-like in their pallor. Looking around him, O'Farrell saw a woman seated alone in one of the boxes. It was the woman he had seen a few minutes before. She was now dressed in a beautiful plum-colored dress and no longer wore the dark blue cloak she'd had on when he saw her first. The woman was leaning forward, staring fixedly at the stage. This was a most remarkable materialization, the best O'Farrell had ever experienced, affecting all the senses but one, smell. Charles O'Farrell distinctly heard the sound of the orchestra playing. At length the curtain rose, and for 5 minutes or so a play unfolded. Yes, there on the stage was the man O'Farrell had seen in the stage manager's room. The man was seated at desk reading when a young man burst in from the right and shot the seated actor. The curtain descended for the end of scene one, and the whole set of remnants dematerialized. Not before O'Farrell, however, saw the lady in the box jump to her feet, applauding enthusiastically. Charles O'Farrell went back to the watchman's booth and had no further occult adventures that night. The owner of the theater was interested in O'Farrell's story and told the old Irish actor of a tragedy that had occurred at a theater on the same site some 3 decades before. A play, The Boss, was then on the theater and starred John Nares and David Niels. Nares, it appeared, was very much in love with Niels' wife, Laura, who led the young man on and repeatedly swore that she hated her husband, who was, she said, cruel to her. In this play, John Nares had to rush on stage and pretend to shoot the boss, David Niels. In reality, live bullets were fired, and unbeknown to the audience, Niels was killed instantly. It was always subsequently thought that Laura Niels bribed the property man to switch the blanks for live bullets. Whether or not Nares was party to this is not known. After the accident, John Nares and Laura vanished. Since that time, the owner explained to Charles O'Farrell in his office the next morning, when the actor recounted his night's adventures, the theater has been deemed haunted. It is interesting to note that Charles O'Farrell knew nothing of the Nares-Niels story before he kept vigil. The new theater is long departed from the Broadway scene and is long forgotten. The site was subsequently sold. The Haunted Jacket. A well-known journalist and psychic researcher recounts a strange story connected with a Victorian jacket that had been purchased at random from a street market by a theater property department for use in a play. The jacket, which dated from the 1890s, was a woman's, a short-backed velvet garment in the style of a bolero. The fashion was known as a monkey jacket. the name derived from the similar short coats worn by Italian organ grinders' monkeys, who used to entertain in the London streets of the time. The jacket had been purchased for use in a play, the action of which was the time of Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee. It was to be worn by the plot's hard-working seamstress, who was played by a well-known English actress. When she first put on the jacket, there seemed to be ample room in it, but after she had worn it a while, she began to experience an unpleasant tightness under the arms and bodice. At first, she dismissed the sensation as imagination, but it grew worse. The unusual tightness after it had begun to be worn was also experienced by the understudy. The stage manager also encountered the same problem, for when she had the jacket on, she saw the apparition of a young woman wearing it. The mystery of the jacket deepened when the wife of the play's director put on the jacket as well. Red weals rose on her throat, marks as such might have been made by human fingers trying to strangle her. Others experienced difficulty in breathing while wearing the jacket. Intrigued by the story, the psychic researcher arranged a seance at the Duke of York's Theatre in St. Martin's Lane, where the play was running. Following a performance of the play, the seance was conducted in the presence of the cast, the stage manager, the director, and his wife. The researcher and three mediums, who had been told nothing of the history of the incidents, reported the following. Medium 1 described that she had no distinct psychic impressions. The second medium said a feeling that the garment had belonged to a young woman. The third medium said, after he had held it for a few moments, that he saw a dramatic vision. There was a young girl, he said, about 18 to 20 years of age. She had a sense of guilt about something. In some way she had provoked anger akin to madness in a man who nevertheless was not essentially evil. The medium said he could see a pair of hands, the rough hands of a workman, tearing at the girl's clothing. The two struggled violently until suddenly the girl fell backwards and there was a splashing as she was forced into a butt of water. The assailant then dragged her body from the water and carried up a flight of stairs into a room, squalid and bare, save for two pieces of furniture. There he wrapped the body in a blanket, then carried it downstairs again, still wet and dripping. At that point, the vision faded. The comments of the last medium were endorsed by the stage manager, who said that she had a vision of similar content while wearing the jacket. The jacket's haunted powers continued for some time, and the garment was later discarded by the property department. It was just deemed too dangerous to use. The case of the hog-faced lady. Some years ago, an actor and his family lived in a house in London's Blackfriars district. The house has now been demolished. When the actor lived there, he was charged only a small rent because no one would live there alone. Desperate for a place to live, the actor took up tenancy and asked no questions. One night, said the actor to friends at Covent Gardens one day, as we were about to retire and had reached the foot of the staircase leading to our bedroom, my wife and I heard footsteps on the landing above us. Both my wife and I were aghast. Oh no, we've got burglars, I gasped, but no. A rustling of a lady's gown followed. Then the air seemed to go chilly and cold. Death seemed to be hovering about in its most terrible form. The footsteps became clearer, and there appeared before our eyes at the top of the stairs a lady in an old-fashioned dress, I should say probably early 17th century. Then she began to descend the stairs. Strange to say, the actor explained, she had the head of a pig, an ugly, repulsive pig, small eyes and snout complete. While down this horrible creature came, moving towards us. My wife screamed and then fainted. I managed to catch her as she fell. Looking up, my wife still in my arms, I observed with great pleasure that the terrible thing had vanished. The actor William Barrett told this to a playwright friend, who within days made a remarkable discovery while researching in a library of the British Museum. He came across a torn, dusty pamphlet published in London in 1641 bearing the title A Certain Relation of the Hog-Faced Gentlewoman. The gist of the story was as follows. The big-faced lady, whose name is Tamakin Skinker, was born at Workham-on-the-Rhine in 1618. Some people assume she is English-born, being a native of Windsor on the Thames. All the limbs and lineaments on her body is well-featured in proportion. Only her face, which is the ornament and beauty of all the rest, has the nose of a hog or swine, which is not only a stain and blemish, but a deformed ugliness making all the rest loathsome, contemptible, and odious to look upon, as described by any that saw her. Her language is only the hoggish Dutch, or the French, oui, oui. 40,000 pounds is the sum offered to the man who will consent to marry her. Her person is most delicately formed and of the greatest symmetry. Her manners are, in general, simple and unoffending. But when she is in want of food, she articulates, certainly something like the sound of pigs when eating, maybe, perhaps, a little disagreeable. Miss Skinker is always dressed well. She is now in London looking for a husband. She lives Blackfriars or Covent Garden. The doubt between the two places is lest the multitude of people who would flock to see her might, in their eagerness, pull the house down in which she resides. It appears that poor Miss Skinker also appeared at taverns and theaters trying to get herself a husband. But there is no record of her wraith at Covent Garden where she once appeared. So is the sad story of the pig-faced lady.